We are on lesson 8, which is the Psalms of Thanksgiving, Psalm 66 and Psalm 118. Oh, I should answer. Lisa had a question on Psalm 46. So they used Psalm 46 on Sunday because it was Reformation Sunday, for probably because of Our Mighty Fortress is Our God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is funny why they didn't use 118, which would have been more realistic. But I understand they used it as hymn. And that is a psalm of trust.
Okay.
So she wondered what it was a psalm of, and I must not have put it in my psalms of trust. So
I don't think you put in 15, I think you did.
Yeah, so tell me if I did. So I didn't purposely like look at all the psalms and say which ones are they. I just listed what I know are these psalms and these psalms. So tell me if there's something missing, and we can talk about that and put those in so you know. Although I think you pretty much by this time should be able to go, oh, I think this might be this or this. Mm-hmm. Especially if you go back to the characteristics of each kind of genre, you should be able to fit them in. Some of them are a little hard. And I would say this psalm, the Psalm 46, mm-hmm. is a little bit harder. And some theologians would waffle on where that goes. But it is definitely a psalm of trust. So, okay. Review. Without looking at your stuff, see if you can say. And since I know you can't read that, it doesn't matter that it's here. Psalms are structured to
respond to Torah.
Psalms are practiced to
train us in conversation with God.
Psalms are read through poetic liturgy to
connect us with God and others.
Okay, to connect our daily lives with God. And the difference between that is connecting us is one thing that's very general, but to connect our daily lives, which means we connect everything. We connect walking through the door, going to the grocery store, doing our dishes, going to work. All of those little things get connected to God and others through the Wisdom Psalms, okay? Because remember, Wisdom Psalms talk about, through all Psalms, help us, the liturgy, to tell others about it. Remember, we're sitting at a table that we're talking to God and to others all about that. So that will specifically have some implications for the Psalms of Thanksgiving as we talk about that today. Torah Psalms help us
see God's word as essential for our lives.
Which begins the conversation, right? So Torah always is the beginning of the conversation. And we need to understand God's words are essential for life. Without having God's words for life, there's not going to be a conversation and then no connection, right? I mean, you could live with your husband or your parents or your friends forever, but have no connection if there's not ever a conversation, right? If you're not listening to them, there's not going to be a conversation. You could talk to them a lot, but if you're never listening to them, there's no conversation and there's no connection. Psalms of the King. Yep. They put us under God's rule so that we are serving him rather than serving ourselves. Wisdom Psalms.
Affirm God's
order so that everybody can flourish. Imprecatory Psalms. Shape.
Shape our anger to righteous anger of sin.
Right. Righteous hatred of sin. Lament Psalms. Shape.
Our despair and hope and restoration.
Okay. And Psalms of Trust. Shape our okay.
Loving kindness.
That's kind of where we've been. So you'll notice that we've kind of had three sections of orientation psalms, right? Torah Psalms, Wisdom Psalms, Psalms of the King. And the last three that we've had have all been reorientation, right? Reorienting our emotions. So we've got three sections, and now we enter into the last two sections. That are a little bit different. They're not so much shaping our emotions as bringing us now with all of that into a new place. So, Psalms of Thanksgiving. The definition of Thanksgiving, the Hebrew word is yada, and it means to shoot an arrow or to give thanks. Now, that seems like two different definitions, but the implication is that when you give thanks, it is actually going towards something outside of you. So that it is not, a lot of times we confuse the Thanksgiving with feeling gratitude, right? But that's not what the Psalms of Thanksgiving are. They're actually giving out of thanks. And it's almost unfortunate that we've put the word together, thanksgiving, because it's giving of thanks. And we put it together as a compound word, right? But once it's a compound word, we don't stop and think about the fact that it's an action given outside of ourselves. The word in the New Testament is, we've done this word before, mm-hmm. Eucharisteo. Remember that? Mm-hmm. So Eucharisteo is an interesting word because it has the word charis in it, which is joy or thanks or good, all three of those. And you is to give out. So to give out thanks or to give out or to give thanks for a good gift. So it means all of those things. The first mention of giving thanks, Eucharisteo, in the New Testament is in Matthew. Does anybody know where?
That when he's talking about what father wouldn't want to give his child a good gift?
Oh, that's good. That kind of precedes that, or it actually comes after that and talks about that. Can you think of any other places where giving thanks is done in the Gospels?
Before he broke the bread?
Yep, that's right. Before he broke the bread, right. So it's right after the Beatitudes. It's the feeding of the 5,000 where Jesus breaks the bread and gives thanks to God, right? And that's important because that's actually a foreshadowing of his breaking the bread at the Last Supper. Mm-hmm. It's the exact same thing. It's an echo of that, and you'll see that. Both in Matthew and Mark, they do the same thing. Both Gospels do the same thing. And use that same phrase. And the interesting thing about it is that Jesus' giving of thanks there is audible. And that's important. If you're going through the Gospels, you'll see the importance of that. But that his thanksgiving is audible. And we're going to find out that the Psalms of Thanksgiving are audible. Mm-hmm. So, again, another one of those paradigm shifts that we need to understand. We'll get there in a minute. So, when we think about thanksgiving, when we think about the Psalms of Thanksgiving, we need to understand that it's giving thanks as an outward act that takes the focus off of ourselves and intentionally focuses on another's generosity of giving, particularly God's generosity of giving. The interesting thing, even if you look in just a secular English dictionary, it always says the giving out of thanks, every dictionary says this, particularly to God. So that's where it comes from. It comes from giving out to God thanksgiving, which I think is pretty fascinating. I looked at several English dictionaries and thought, every one of them, particularly to God.
I bet they'll change that, though.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see that.
The way the world is going.
I think, you know, with dictionaries are very good about the historical stuff. And even if they change it in the main definition, it will always be in the etymology. So I think that's, if anybody, I mean, I love etymology. I think that's one of the interesting things about language, to see where it comes from and where it's been. It also actually comes from the word think. To thank is comes from the word to think. So it's actually a very intentional thing.
Does
so
the dictionary use a capital G or a small
capital
G?
Capital G. So the purpose of the Psalms of Thanksgiving is really fourfold, but the main one is so that it moves our focus from ourselves to God. Remember that emotion, are given to move us. But what happens without the giving of thanks is that our movement remains constricted within ourselves. So we just go around in a circle over and over and over again, right? So my fear moves me, my anger moves me, it moves me, but unless it is shaped by God, it's always going to move me in this circle. Even if it's shaped by God, it's going to continue to move me in a circle, and what it will do is it will move me close to God. So this is me, these are my emotions, and it keeps moving me toward God, right? So that's the whole purpose of our emotions getting shaped by the Psalms. It moves me toward God so that I'm actually beginning to come into God's atmosphere, right? That's what it happens to do. But without thanksgiving, it just remains in this circle. The second piece, then, of moving, it moves the focus off of us to God. It helps us to enter, then, into God's space. So when God answers our cries, right now this is very constricting, right? there's it moves, but it just keeps moving over and over again, which is why I asked you the question about what's constricting when you're moving. And it's almost feeling like you're in a loop all the time. If you're, whatever it was that was your issue, like you can't get past it. Thanksgiving is a response to your cry of lament that God answered. So Thanksgiving always comes out of God answering and thus cutting off that constriction. So he says, I've answered you. And now, well, this isn't going to work very well. In my head, I wanted to do the railroad and get Bill's old railroad thing out, but I haven't had out in, you know, 20 years. And I thought, oh, that's probably not a good idea. So I don't have my tape. So when he does that, let's see if this works. He opens up our space, and then now how are we able to move? Into his life, right? Into his life, rather just not close to his life, but actually now we're going to participate in his life. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
So that the Psalms of Thanksgiving are actually this brand new opening up of this broad space for us. So no longer are we coming to God with our cries, and we're coming near him, right? We're coming to him, but it's our cries. And our cries don't just include the lament, but at first it starts with our imprecatory cries, right? I hurt. And then our lament cries, where are you, God? And then the trust cries. And the trust cries haven't moved into his life yet. They have said, I'm going to wait here. I'm not going to move away again because I trust that you've in the past helped me before. I trust you're going to help me again. So it's, I'm going to stay there. Trust is always a waiting game. It's in the Thanksgiving where God has answered now. God has brought you deliverance. He's delivered you in some way. And you answer him and say, thank you. You did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And that opens up the gates so that now we can actually go this way and go into that. Oh, I think it's upstairs. My pericritic, yeah. You know, our Mobius. Well, that's what I tried to create, and I'm thinking, I don't know how to do this. Annie, that. Why didn't you buy that?
Well, $700.
Yeah, that's what I figured. So I have looked for several years for a metal pericritic Mobius, and I've actually even asked a metal guy if he could make it, and he couldn't. But that's what I've always wanted, and she found one at Restoration Hardware. So it's about this big, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
gorgeous.
Exactly.
It's gorgeous.
No, it's beautiful.
And I thought, ooh, I should tell her to buy it. And then I thought, yeah, it's probably, Restoration Hardware is probably expensive. But in my head, I think that would be the best sculpture to have, right? Totally. It's this beautiful metal pericritic Mobius that keeps going. This shows us, this is what we're made for. We're made to participate in that. I mean, that is movement, right? This is not. This is kind of a, I'm stuck. And if you go into Judges, what happens if you're stuck all the time is you pretty much spiral down. But this Mobius is this flow of life that we're supposed to go in. That's what the Psalms of Thanksgiving help us do, is they allow God to open the floodgates so that we can actually get back on that track. So I really wanted this railroad. You know how the railroads have those switches, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where they switch, and all of a sudden now you can go on the other track, and they switch back, and they go. So that forms more of a Mobius idea. Yep, it is. It exactly is. So that would be in my head when I have this idea of finding somebody who will do this. Not only will I have this metal Mobius, but I want it stamped out, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, in there, so you can see the.
You are really picky.
I'm really picky. I know, and nobody will do it for me right now. So
you should talk to Karen Johnson and have her make one out of her.
Out of clay.
Out of her clay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good idea.
That's a good idea.
Because I think she can do that.
Ooh. Okay. Think about that. So, without Thanksgiving, our movement is constricted. We move, but we keep moving in the same circle. And we're moving in God's sphere, but we're not participating in his life. Because it's still always focused on us, right? All three of those our imprecatories, our laments, and our trust are still, it's all about me. All of a sudden, when God answers, we get to flow into his life, right? And we thank him, and it's all about what he's done rather than our situation. You see what happened? The thing floats. So I'll tell you about my dog experience, which I think could have been this and wasn't. So again, I'm taking a walk. I see a lady with two dogs. They're small. I'm not really afraid of them. I still don't like them. And I just think, okay, this is not a big deal. So I just keep walking past. And the dog is on one of those long, long leashes that keep moving. And the dog actually starts running toward me and starts biting at my leg.
Oh, my gosh.
She can't stop it because of that.
Oh, yeah, she can. She literally didn't move. She didn't pull the dog. She didn't say anything except something like,
"Old Fluffy."
Yeah, it was basically that, "Old Fluffy." And here's the weird thing. I screamed. You know I'm afraid of dogs. The dog came at me. He started nipping at me, and I screamed. Now, I didn't scream loud, but I screamed. She heard it. I just went, "Oh!" like that. And the lady never pulled the leash and didn't say anything but, "Oh, Fluffy." And I just thought, here was an opportunity. I screamed. You did not answer my cry. Mm-hmm. Had you answered my cry by pulling the dog back, I would have said, thank you. Mm-hmm. And in saying thank you, we would have had a beginning of a conversation. Mm-hmm. What happened instead was I walked away more afraid of dogs, yep. More not trusting mm-hmm. people who own dogs, yep. And more angry. And I was angry the whole time, even thinking about it. I think
it makes me mad.
It makes me mad. And this has happened to me a couple times. I'm not so concerned about what's happening to me, but it cuts off the possibility, right, of any kind of conversation. There could have been an ugly conversation. And sometimes I've done that. But what I want us to see is what happens is when someone cries out and the other answers, there opens up this possibility now of, thank you. You've done something for me I couldn't do. I could not do anything about this dog. I was afraid. I didn't want to be bitten. Even though it was a small dog and I knew I wasn't going to get hurt badly, it's still
invasive.
Very invasive. And it still nipped at me.
Trust again. Yeah.
And trust right. And trust again is gone. The idea of God hearing our cries and answering us and doing something about it opens the gates for us to say, thank you for doing something for me that I couldn't have done for myself. And then we have this participation in someone else's life. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that's the idea of the Psalms of Thanksgiving.
I'm sorry this digresses, but did something happen to you as a child that made
yes.
you afraid of?
I got attacked twice. Bitten once and attacked. And both were very
traumatic.
Traumatic enough that interesting, and I tell this story all the time, Robin's husband Brett and I grew up in the same block. We didn't know about this until we started talking. He was afraid of dogs for the same reason.
Same
for the same dog.
Same dog.
Same dog.
Big dogs, little dogs.
Big dog, German Shepherd.
Me too.
Yeah. So it plays into that. But if someone screams, someone cries out, as the other person, our response should be, I want to answer that person, right? Whatever it is, and however foolish it might seem to them, right? It's not an answer to say, oh, don't worry, he won't bite you, he's so sweet. That's not an answer to your cry, right? That's a building up of yourself. I'm not going to, yeah. Mm-hmm. But God doesn't say, don't worry about that, guys. He answers our call. I know you're afraid, and I'm here for you, mm-hmm. right? And then it opens up the gates for us to say, thank you for doing what I could not do. So it takes away that constriction that we felt. So for me, literally, I can feel my insides going like this.
Oh, that's too bad.
And just pulling in. Yeah.
Explain, if you would say this person would have said to you, I'm sorry, or as a dog, I'm not saying this, when kids come up to see your cute little dog, or maybe medium dog, this is immaterial, you would say, stay back, stand still, let the dog get used to you. Explain how that would fit into.
Well, we're not talking there about, we're talking a completely different situation.
But would that be part of the opening up and allowing?
Yeah, it could, it can be. But that's not what we're talking about in Psalms of Thanksgiving. Psalms of Thanksgiving always comes as a response to a cry that was heard and answered. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's what we're talking about. And I hate to get mired into the idea of dogs. It's just that to me, that was a very, like, opportunity for, a cry is always an opportunity for connection and relationship. So, and that's what God does. When he hears our cries and he answers them, and then his answer opens up, just like that paragraph thing, the possibility of me participating in his life. And it assures that the movement, when we did this, the movement is no longer only in my life, right? The movement goes outside of me. And now, because of that, I focus on what God has done rather than how I felt. So that now the focus is brought, my whole place, my whole life has been broadened because of that answer. So it's this idea of, remember we talked about the idea of us as priests, our job is to be reflective of God who names, who tends, and who makes space. And that's the making space part, is I'm making space for you to be able to participate in my life, for you to have the opportunity to take in that opening. So, to complete, so the Psalms of Thanksgiving, in order to take our focus off of ourselves, to enter into the broad space God has made us, and then to complete that perichoretic circle, participating in God's life. So in imprecatory, lament, and trust psalms, our conversation was still focused on us giving him our broken lives, right? We were just giving them over to him, our broken lives. With thanksgiving, we receive his answer to our prayers, our answer to our cry, and then with our relief, we allow his life to overwhelm our life, and then we give to him. We give out. So it's this, and this is what we always talk about when we talk about perichoretic life. It's always a bringing in and a giving out. Bringing in and a giving out. When we give out in thanksgiving, we're not any longer just giving broken lives. Now we're giving over a reoriented life. So in giving him our fears and our anger, our broken stuff, he takes it, he starts to repair it, and he gives us deliverance. And in that deliverance, he transforms us so that we are reoriented to him, and now we're giving him a reoriented life. So do you see that it has to have all of it? It can't just have one part of it. And I'm always cautious about, and I think maybe this is why we've lost imprecatory and lament psalms in the church, is because we're nervous about it ending there, right? We can't just stay in a mode of always lamenting. God wants us to move. But it will come in thanksgiving. And I think we've even lost that. So we've got to do all of it. Thanksgiving can't come without the imprecatory and lament and trust. So we have to have all of that, but we also have to have the thanksgiving. In Thanksgiving Psalms, there's always also an invitation to others. The giving of thanks is meant to be proclaimed, not just said to God alone. And this is very clear in all the Thanksgiving Psalms. It's meant to be heard in the community and in society at large, which is very different than all the other Psalms, except for the praise Psalms that we'll get to. And that is the reflection that we are called to give to the world, right? Is this full circle relationship of Hesed, of loving kindness that God has that flows, that makes our lives flow, and meets our deepest need for belonging. So when we think about that, We also need to think about what actually Thanksgiving does for us. So that it not just moves us into participating in God's life, it doesn't just cut off our constriction, but it also does some really interesting physiological things in our brain. This, to me, is always really fascinating when we find this out. So first of all, the neurological benefits, when we give thanks, the brain floods with reward chemicals. But it only does so when your gratitude is actually focused on a specific person. So it doesn't do that just to feel gratitude, just to feel, oh, this is nice. I'm so thankful. It always comes when it's focused on a specific person. And for Thanksgiving Psalm, it always is focused on God. It activates rewards that are targeted to boost bonds with other people, to boost relationship. So that's what the neurological impulses actually target, is those places. So that it makes you want to feel the same feeling again, which means you'll want to make connections again. So when we don't give thanks to God and literally move into his life, we don't feel the necessity to do it again. When we give thanksgiving specifically, when we specifically mention what it is that we're thankful for and we specifically give it thanks to God, we begin to feel like we want to feel that again. And so that our connection with God and with others will increase. Here's an interesting thing, though, that I also read. They did find that you won't increase in thanksgiving, that you won't do it more and more often unless you actually keep track. So just like when you're on a diet, they say the best way to do it is that you keep track of your food, right, that your intake, so you actually write it down, because we are so, we think more highly of ourselves than we ought. And we think, oh, I hardly had anything to eat today. You know, I think I had one or two things, that's it. But if we write it down, we realize, oh, we did a lot. Same thing happens with Thanksgiving. If you actually don't keep track, if you actually don't count how many times you've given thanks specifically, you will think that you're always giving thanks. But what happens is you just remain with the feeling and you never give it out. So that it, in keeping track, it actually helps. Which is why a lot of times it helps, and we've done this before, I don't remember even what study we're doing, but we kept track, right, of three things every day that we were thankful for, right? The thing that we left off is, did we say it to God, and did we tell others about it? But actually writing down, so we did that so that we came up with 1,000 things by the end of the semester. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Only, maybe just a handful of you. And that was really helpful and actually began to increase more and more your thankfulness and that brain flooding with chemicals. It also lessens the symptoms of anxiety and depression, which I think is fascinating, considering that's just what we've done, right, in Psalms. Psalm says, give your fears to God, give your despair to God, and then thanksgiving when he answers, and those things will be lessened. It lessens those, first of all, by helping your sleep. So first of all, it helps you fall asleep faster, and it helps you have a more full sleep. So going through all the cycles and being able to go through all of those, restful. It calms you and it boosts your mood. And the reason it boosts your mood is because it challenges any negative thought patterns. The third thing it does is it causes your hypothalamus to work better. Your hypothalamus is very important because it's responsible for your hunger. It's responsible to regulate your hunger, your sleep, your body temperature, your metabolism, and your growth. So if giving of thanks causes your hypothalamus to excel and run more smoothly, it means that your hunger pangs will be more honest, right? Your sleep will be better, your body temperature will be regulated better, your metabolism will work better, and your growth will work, will be more on target.
You know,
sure.
I'm thinking it would be a great little gift to give
give them a blank book.
Oh, yes.
Have what you said in front so they all have that.
Sure, I can do that.
Thank you.
It also makes you more resistant to stress. And this we've talked about before a lot with Brené Brown, right? Mm-hmm. So this is one of her big things is resiliency. So it makes you resilient and less vulnerable to continued stress, but it also gives you the ability to bounce back from some very serious stresses and recover quicker. So, Carolyn, it's where I was aiming at when I was speaking with you this morning, is instead of us looking at all the things that we don't like about what's going on and we're in a lot of stress, right? Which is what we do, right? We're in a lot of stress. And so we're just going to delineate all the stress. God says, hey, why don't you thank me for how I've answered you? And what happens then is the stress begins to diminish, right? Physiologically, it diminishes. So it's not this idea of, oh, I'll just feel better. No, it actually physically helps you to be able to do that. And lastly, it causes you to experience more positive emotions overall. So people who are consistent in giving thanks are more empathetic. They become more empathetic. They become more forgiving. They become more helpful, and they become more supportive. One of the reasons it does is because now it trains the prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain, to retain positive information and to reject negative information. So interesting that all of those things happen within your brain to make you a more whole person, which is what's happening when you give thanks to God and you allow the opening to start living in his pericritic life, right? All of those things, empathetic, forgiving, helpful, supportive, don't those look like God's characteristics? Yeah. So it should never be a surprise to you, but I think it always is one of those, oh, that's so cool, to know that what God has brought us to, what God is pulling us toward, is always a more healthful and whole self, physiologically, emotionally, spiritually. So, again, the Psalms do things for our lives that are more than just, we categorize lives, right, into our spiritual life and our physical life. By the way, that's a Western thought, doing that. Most of the world doesn't do that. But the Bible says we're whole beings, and God is dealing with the whole being. So finally we get to, what do Psalms of Thanksgiving look like? So the characterizations are, first of all, it reports a crisis and records its nature. So it's very specific about what distress you've gone through. There's been a distress and what you've already gone through. Secondly, there's a statement that the crisis is past and deliverance is an accomplished fact. So very different than trust, right? Because trust usually is, I'm still in this. I'm not so focused on the distress, but I'm still in the distress. But I'm going to trust you. I'm going to wait here because I know you're going to do something about it. Whereas Thanksgiving, crisis has passed, God has answered it, he's delivered you, and now you have this ability to give thanks. The interesting thing about the characterizations of Psalms of Thanksgiving is they don't have to use the word thank you. It doesn't have to be iterated in the psalm. It can simply tell of what God has done to rescue you, what God has done to deliver you. And often the terms are more praise terms than they are thank terms. You'll see both, right? In 66, we will see the praise terms, and in 118, we'll see the thankful terms. All of which, when we talk about praise next week, we'll see that those are all praise things. So when you're trying to identify a psalm as a Thanksgiving psalm, the word thanks isn't really your guide so much as, has a crisis passed and God has delivered, and they're now telling of what God has done for them specifically. So those are the two that must be there in order for it to be a Thanksgiving psalm.
Is that why those are bolded?
Yes, those are, yes. So I always bold the ones that have to be there. These others can be in there and often are. An intention to worship, which is praise that rises out of gratitude. A call or an invitation to join in thanks or praise. And this is pretty common with Thanksgiving praises, is that they don't want to give thanks alone. They want everyone to join them. There's also often a vow to praise or make sacrifice, which is just putting into action what your words have said. And then there might be a statement of God's faithfulness. So those are the characterizations of the Psalms of Thanksgiving. Psalm 66, who is that?
Well, so we can explain why you guys are passing around. So you can see with this song as you read it that there's just a lot of rich words, and it's clearly about praising. There's a lot about song, so we'll get to a song at the end of this. But we kind of went back to what do these words mean? And so we looked at the Hebrew and the Hebrew to amplify what they mean. So what we want to do is we're going to read... So the yellow is the word that we look further into. Mm-hmm. So we're going to read the black or the highlighted yellow parts, and then your part is the red, so the amplification of that word. So you guys, so just to like chew on what that word really means. And always there's a danger of translating it properly. So we tried to keep it in context, because some of these words we might not have gotten exactly right, but hopefully in context we've gotten the gist of everything. So we're going to read, you guys will read the red parts as they come. How's that? Make sense? So, shout joyfully to God.
Make a joyful noise, cry out in triumph.
All the earth, sing.
Place glory, make music.
The glory of his name, make his praise.
A new song.
Glorious. Say to God.
Turn all of your praises.
How awesome are your works, because of the greatness of your power. Your enemies will give feigned obedience, or
be insufficient, deal falsely
to you. All the earth will worship you.
Bow down.
And will sing praises to you.
Make music.
They will sing praises.
Make music.
To your name.
Come and see.
Gaze upon, behold, heed.
The works of God. Who is awesome in his deeds towards the sons of men. He turned the sea into dry land. They passed through the river on foot. Then let us rejoice in him.
Be glad, exult.
He rules by his might forever. His eyes keep watch on the nations. Let not the rebellious exalt themselves.
Be set on high.
Bless our God.
Bow down, adore our God.
O peoples, and sound his praise abroad.
A new song.
Who keeps us in life.
Sets or appoints.
And does not allow our feet to slip.
Shake or waver.
For you have tried us, O God.
Scrutinized, tested, approved.
You have refined us as silver is refined. You brought us into the net.
snare or stronghold.
You laid,
set or appointed,
an oppressive burden upon our loins. You made men ride over our heads. We went through the fire and through water, yet you brought us out into a place of abundance.
Saturation runneth over.
I shall come into your house with burnt offerings. I shall pay you my vows.
Offerings, things promised.
Which my lips uttered and my mouth spoke.
Declared, promised.
When I was in distress. I shall offer to you.
Ascend, go up, climb.
Burnt offerings of fat beasts. With the smoke of rams, I shall make an offering of bulls with male goats.
Come and hear.
Listen, obey, Shema.
All who fear God, and I will tell.
Recount, count exactly.
Of what he has done for my soul. I cried to him.
Called out, proclaimed.
With my mouth, and he was extolled.
Set on high.
With my tongue. If I regard wickedness in my heart,
iniquity, trouble, sorrow, idolatry.
The Lord will hear.
Listen, obey, Shema.
But certainly God has heard.
Shema.
He has given heed to the voice of my prayer. Blessed be God.
Bow down to and adored.
Who has not turned away my prayer, nor his loving kindness from me.
Goodness, faithfulness, merciful favor, steadfast love.
And then, hopefully I can pull this off, we found a song that's mm-hmm. based on Psalm 66. And at first I thought that it was a little bit too only the positives, you know, because as we learned in studying, you bring everything to him and you talk about the bad part too. But then the first word says it all. He's inviting people in, so you'll go through that in a second. Should have had it keyed up, sorry. So we can sing it, I think. you'll catch the
Oh, come.
notice that when often when people do songs on the Psalms, they do exactly what we've done, and they take one particular piece, right? And that they can tell is the theme of that. And so he actually used the ones that we use. Shout joyfully to God, all the earth. I will tell of what he's done for my soul.
Oh, of course.
But, I mean, that just tells you that's really the theme there of that. I mean, it really helps you to see where that's going. So as we get to Psalm 66, one of the things that you need to know about the Psalms of Thanksgiving, particularly, is that although they still respond to their corresponding Torah book, Psalms of Thanksgiving will often incorporate all of the Torah. So you'll see a reflection of all of the Torah in Thanksgiving, which really goes along with Thanksgiving, since it opens up for us being able to participate in all of God's life. So that we begin to see all of Torah as a place where we can bring our thanksgiving of what God has done. So the context of Psalm 66, of course, is book two, which means David is king, finally, right? After all of book one and him waiting and waiting, God has finally brought him into kingship. Which means that they have been in a constricted place in book one, right, in their history under Saul. Because under Saul, Saul was a reflection of what it looks like to serve yourself, to be self-centered, and to just keep on only being concerned about you, right? Even when you think about just the few things you know about Saul, right, when he was upset, when he was angry, what did he do? He had David play, but he didn't actually call David to play. Somebody else did, right? He was always internalizing, right? It was always this for Saul. So we have that picture of that happening. And, of course, Saul got to be king because the people were doing that. They were just focusing on themselves, what they want, what they want, what they want. So when we have David come in, we have the gates open now so that all of Israel can be affected by God opening the gates. So David has been crying all through their history of him being not on the throne yet, even though he's anointed. And now we have God answering David's cry of delivering him from all of his enemies, right? He gets delivered from Saul. I mean, if you didn't know the whole story and you were reading all this stuff about David before he gets on the throne, you would think he's never going to get on the throne, right? I mean, the king wants to kill him. You don't think it'll happen, but it does. God delivers him, and he ends up on the throne. And God's answer to David doesn't just affect David, right? Because God's answer to David also affects all of Israel. And the truth is, it doesn't just affect Israel, it affects us. Because whatever happens to Israel will result in something happening to us. We know that because of the Abrahamic covenant. And we know that because Israel had David on the throne, we know that that ends up having Christ on the throne and therefore our salvation. So God answering David's cry has to do with us as well. And we have to be thinking big term now. And that's really what happens in Thanksgiving. And we'll begin to see that our Thanksgiving begins by thanking God from Torah, from what he has done for Israel. Because what he's done for Israel results in our salvation. If he hadn't done for Israel what he did in Torah, we would not be here. The Torah parallel, of course, is Exodus, the redemption of Israel. And, of course, this is the base story for Israel, right? If you know any Jews, whether they are practicing Jews, whether they are conservative or liberal, progressive, right? What did you say?
Reformed.
Thank you. Well, it doesn't matter, right?
Messianic, right?
No. And there's also Messianic, but it doesn't matter where you fall in that spectrum as a Jew. Passover, the Exodus, is your foundational story, right? And as a Jew, I don't care who you are, and I've known several Jews, and it doesn't matter if they're absolutely not religious at all. Exodus is still their story. And that Passover is their story.
And they recognize that.
And they recognize it and they celebrate that regardless. Mm-hmm. Because that was God saying, I'm faithful to my covenant and you are my people. I'm making you my people. So not only was it deliverance, but it was making them his people once again. Because of the Exodus story being foundational for the Jews, it's also foundational for us. So that God's faithfulness to his people in the Exodus is his faithfulness to us. And sometimes we don't understand why God says, I want you to hold up the Jewish people. And one of them is, one of the reasons is because if it weren't for the Jewish people, we would not have been brought into the family of God. So that our thankfulness starts at what God did for the Jewish people. His saving of the Jewish people out of Egypt began our redemption. Began our redemption as well as theirs. When we look at the context of Psalm 66, what we would do is recognize from common words and all, is that 65 and 66 come as a pair. And Psalm 65 is a celebration of God as creator. And then when we get to 66, it's a celebration of God as recreator, as delivering the world from their walking away from what he originally created and restoring creation. So we see these two pairs with 65 and 66. I hope you notice what I've been doing in the lessons is I haven't always gone through the temple language and the poetic language and because I'm trying to, first of all, kind of narrow it down to what's most important, what's going to bring out some of the pieces. So we're coming back then now to the temple language here because what we'll notice in 66, actually we'll notice in all Thanksgiving Psalms, is who it's addressed to. A lot of times we've had our psalms either addressed to the people sitting around the table or specifically just to God. But Thanksgiving Psalms gets addressed to everyone. So we'll see that as we look at 66. So the temple language is, first of all, it gets addressed to the world. Shout joyfully to God, all the earth. So when we're sitting around the table, Thanksgiving, and he's starting it this way, he's actually turning away from on his chair and going, hey, everybody, you've got to know what God did. This is what God did. So he's not just talking to the people who are at the table. He's not just talking to the community of Israel. He says, with Thanksgiving, this is a reflection of who God is. You've got to tell everybody what he did. You've got to tell everybody what he did specifically for you. This is where we go with Thanksgiving. So that it's an invitation to everyone. Because what he does for Israel, he does for everyone. And we must understand that connection, that it isn't he did it for Israel and he might or might not do it for you. He did it for Israel so that he could do it for everyone. That's the gate. Because of what he's done for Israel, us telling that to the world inspires awe and praise and thanksgiving to those who aren't specifically Israel and reminds them that that's where all of our redemption began. And every time I talk about this, there's this underlying angst about, as in the Christian world, we talk about how we should be supporting Israel. And I think that's really dangerous to leave it there. Because what Thanksgiving Psalm tells us is we're to support Israel in their honest thanksgiving to God, in the places where they're looking to God. Not political Israel, not Israel, whatever they do, but Israel, turn to God. Israel, look to God. We want them to keep looking to God. And we're going to see pieces of this as we get into the background of Psalm 118. So we have to be careful when we say that. We need to understand that Israel, we come from Israel. But that means that we're kin to Israel and we have to desire their good as well. Not whatever they want. It's like It's like anybody that we love, we don't just say, well, you know, they wanted to take drugs, so, you know, let them take drugs. Right? We don't support them that way, do we? No, how would we support someone like that? Pull them over, right? That's not the way to life. That's not the way to life. So I say that only because sometimes in evangelical circles, we give a blank statement, we need to support Israel. And we got to be careful about what that means. In Psalm 66, when he talks about having everyone shout joyfully to the earth of what God has done, he brings in Israel's notice in the second stanza. He tells the whole world what God has done for Israel specifically, right? And what's he talking about there in the second stanza of Psalm 66?
Crossing the Dead Sea.
Yeah, right. So their main deliverance, right? The Passover deliverance. That's what he's talking about. And he's telling the world about this. Because that's the beginning of all redemption. That's the beginning of where he's going with the whole world. And he says, he rules by his might forever. So he's reminding the world, look, this is not a one-time event. This is how he rules. He delivers. And he's always delivering. And secondly, God keeps his watch on the nations. What that should do is turn you back to Psalm 2, right? Psalm 2, we're talking about, hey, nations, you think you can get away with not honoring God? God is the deliverer, and he's the only deliverer. He's the only one who's going to give you life. But he's watching you. And he's watching you because he wants to deliver you as well through this means. So it's this both, this watch that God does on the nations is not just to make sure that they turn, but to make sure they know he's a God for them as well. I think Psalm 66 is one of the few places where you see at least some of Israel beginning to embrace their nationality's vocation as a priest to the world, right? To say, hey, we are supposed to be priests to the world and to go and proclaim God's goodness for them. Here next addresses Israel. So the third stanza starts out, bless our God, O peoples. So now he's talking to Israel. So now he's talking to the people at the table. And he says, to do so, sound his praise abroad. Here he says, go be priest to the world. This is really unusual because we've seen too many times, especially in the prophets, right? In Jonah, we saw this. Like, Jonah doesn't want to go to the world, right? He doesn't want to go abroad. He wants to go abroad to run away, but he doesn't want to go abroad to shout the praises of God. Israel so often didn't want to do that. And yet here the psalmist is saying, Israel, we need to do this. We need to go out and share God's desire for a relationship with all. And then he reminds them, Israel, that they're in this together of all their distress. Janet and Jane, thank you. I like that you brought all those definitions out and you brought some of theirs. Mm-hmm. There's one definition that you might be interested in, the one where he says that you laid an oppressive burden upon our loins. Yeah. What it actually is you put a rope around our waist. Mm-hmm. And that is a picture of, it was very common, particularly in Egypt, to put a rope around the slaves' waists so that they were restricted, mm-hmm. so that they knew they weren't free. I have this picture in my head when Christian lived in Syria. He, on his way out to the monastery, he used to always see this little boy tied with a rope around a rock. And I always think about that picture. I think the little boy was probably handicapped in some way, and that was the way of keeping safe, right? But by restriction. And in some ways, that's what God was doing in Israel, right? He was allowing their oppressors to restrict them. And it says here, but that was for our refinement, not for our punishment. That was so that we didn't go any farther away from God than we already were at that time, that we stayed in one place, and that Israel began to experience what it would be like to have live without his obvious presence. So that those years in Egypt, for the most part, were very unattentive to God. They really did not call on God during that time until the very end when they were just so distressed. And of course, another part of God's allowing them to have a rope around their waist to restrict them is to make sure that they would come to a place where they finally wanted to cry out, right? Have you ever been in the car, especially winter's coming, right? We're going to have on these bulky coats, and you're in the car, and you're driving, and you're just feeling like, oh, oh. And there comes a point where you just pull over and you rip it off, right? That's the point God wanted Israel to get to, right? He puts a rope around them. I don't want you going further, but I also want you to feel this, what it feels like to be restricted. Because this isn't what I intended for you. I want you to be free. But if I give you the freedom without you crying out to me, you won't have a connection with me, and you won't begin to participate in my life. You'll just go farther away. Mm-hmm. So it's until that point where you cry out, and then I can answer you and deliver you, because then you know you can't have full life without me. And it is you, it is me helping you to do what you couldn't do, to take off that rope. So that's what he's talking about here in the idea of refining. We've talked about the refining process enough that we don't need to go through that. Then what does he do after he has them in this confining place? It says he brought them to a
place of abundance.
This place of being quenched completely. Mm-hmm. And a place of abundance is always this big, broad, open place, right? Mm-hmm. This place where they can actually have freedom. Until they cried out, though, that freedom would have been a bad thing for them, right? When they cried out, now the gates open and they can participate in that life. Some of the, I thought about, it's as if a child who is always coming to mom and dad, you know, whenever they're hurt or whenever they need something, or when they're hungry, they come and they come and they come and they come, they keep coming. But there comes a point, and think about it when you were a child, there comes a point when you all of a sudden recognize your parents for actually being a separate person that isn't just a food machine, right? That they're a person who's actually been sacrificing for you all this time and giving out. And all of a sudden you want to do something for mom or dad. Can you think of a time when that happened? It's almost this switch. I can remember as a kid, my mom was really good about holidays, and she was, I think her love language was small gifts, because she always was giving small gifts. So every holiday, it didn't matter what holiday it was, small or little, there were gifts. And of course, Christmas time came, and she would make these big stockings for all of us. There came a point when all of a sudden it dawned on me, all of us get stockings but mom. Mm-hmm. Oh, she's a person who's been giving out. I want to give to her. And of course, I didn't have the means, or I don't have any idea how old I was, but I went and found a pair of nylons. Well, those are stockings. This is what I'm thinking in my head. And I began to fill those with things for my mom. That's the idea that God is getting us to, is beginning to realize all of a sudden that God is no longer what we thought is this Santa Claus type guy, right? That he just gives. Oh, all of a sudden, he's been sacrificing for us this whole time, giving out. He's a person other than me, and now I want to give to him. So that's that idea of where God has addressing Israel in this this oppression and this refining place of us being able to recognize who God is, and that his giving out has been waiting for us to give to him. Then the individual, the psalmist, speaks for himself, and he says, I shall come into your house to pay you my vows. That's in the middle of that second section, so sometimes I wonder why they made that one long section. I shall come into your house. When he's received his cry, the answer to his cry, he comes into his house not merely for refuge, which was the trust psalm, right? I've come into for refuge. That's, I'm coming here just to hide. Now the psalmist is coming here to engage with God. Like I told you with the stocking idea, that I don't just want to realize my mom is a place where I get refuge. My mom is a place where I'm always getting things I need or want. Now I want to engage with her and be able to live in her life and recognize her as a person. So the psalmist then turns his emotional relief into action, into this act of gratitude that's focused on giving to God rather than just receiving from God. And then when he does that, he wants everyone to hear all about it. So I don't know if when I filled those stockings with gifts for my mom, if I didn't say to all my sisters, hey guys, what do you think? We should do this. My guess is I didn't because...
Right. What was your idea?
Well, because my family just didn't work that way. I was the oldest and they would have just thought I was bossy.
She was bossy.
So the individual psalmist wants everybody to know, this is what God has done for me. And he wants them to know what God has done, and he wants them to thank God as well. Come with me. Thank God with me. I'm really excited about this. He understands that his receiving deliverance isn't a private matter. We are such individuals, such private people, that when God delivers us, we often don't share that, right? But then we take away the invitation to others to recognize that God is a God of deliverance. He is a God of Hesed who wants to deliver, and he wants to have be cried out to and be seen as a person who's giving. He wants that, and we cut off the invitation when we don't. We also cut off the revelation of God's character, mm-hmm. of who he is. So this is where I think about, I wonder sometimes if when horrible things happen. Okay, yesterday we had another terrorist attack, right?
Yes.
And so two things. First of all, every commentator I heard said, this is our new normal. Mm-hmm. And I'm screaming at him, this is not our new normal.
No.
This has happened twice in New York City. How is that normal? This has happened once in San Bernardino and once in Florida. How is that normal? That's not normal. You are now flattening it, right?
Yeah.
So that was my first thought.
Even if it happens all the time, it's not normal.
Yes.
That's right.
But my second thought is, how does the church respond here? And often the church responds like the culture responds, right? Mm-hmm. We complain. We say, this is horrible. We hurt. But the problem is that the Psalms have told us that kind of talk goes to God. God, we hurt. God, what are you going to do about it? Where are you? Rather than to the community, right? And when God answers, that's when we go outside and say, look what God has done. We as the church, as the people of the Psalms, we share with people what God has done. This is what God has done so that we reflect. The problem comes with we become, remember about the idea of what the happens in your brain with Thanksgiving, is we put that aside, right? And we join the throng of people lamenting to each other rather than to God. But then where comes the thanks? Every once in a while I did hear, I don't know who it was, I think maybe it was the mayor that said, thank you for the first responders. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he did.
Okay, that was good, right? Mm-hmm. We're thinking about that. Let's thank them. We begin to change the mind of our society when we're always looking at the what's happening without lamenting to God and then thanking God for what he's done, right? For what deliverance has happened here. Always starting with, God is a God who is meant to redeem. He redeemed in Exodus, and he is continuing to do that. We can find it everywhere. It doesn't have to be particularly just in this little place.
Jill?
Yeah.
They showed a picture of a man who came over from England, and he was just here, and he was right there when it happened, and he got his cell phone out, and he took a picture, and he was saying something to the effect of, we need to be aware of our surroundings all the time, whereas we're not over here, but they were over, he's from England,
mm-hmm.
and he said, we need to teach people to be constantly aware. And I'm thinking, I don't know whether I want to totally be constantly aware, because that could bring fear, but if you give it to God and really give it to Him, you can have a peace and just go on with life.
So what should we be constantly aware of?
Your surroundings is what He would say.
Yeah, but what does...
Dangerous people.
Who said that? Janie.
We need to be constantly
aware of God's presence.
Yeah. Yes.
That's what the Psalms have been doing, is shaping us, reshaping us from what the culture wants to shape us as to what God wants to shape us. And if we are people walking around constantly aware of God's presence and saying so, we begin to change the mind of society as well.
I've told so many people in the last week about, you know, fearing God and recognizing that He's the one with the power.
Yes.
And like, oh, it's just such a different definition.
Yes.
You know? So instead of fearing people and fearing our surroundings, that constant fear of God and that He's got the power and the circumstances may be really hard and awful and trying, but if we're fearing Him, we know He's got the power and He's working good even in the midst.
Yeah, I think that's a very helpful way for us to begin looking at that. The other thing I want to say about Thanksgiving is when we give thanks, when we truly give thanks, we're pointing to God, right, and to what God has done. We're taking the focus off ourselves. I do think sometimes we get into that very strange area where our public Thanksgiving is actually a very subtle reference to how well we are connected with God, how well we pray. I've been to Thanksgiving services where people are thanking God, but it's all about, because I prayed. God did this because I prayed. God did this because I have just kept on keeping my eyes in Him. That's not a Thanksgiving. And I think that's a really subtle way, but I've walked out of Thanksgiving services thinking, who are we thinking about as we walked out? That person and how holy that person is? If so, something was missing there. It is giving thanks to God, not because we prayed, but because God is a God who is answering us all the time. So we have to be careful about the way we give thanks. And it's very subtle, even in our own heart, I think sometimes, right? And I know I've done this myself. I think about how people will come and tell us, oh, this is what happened to me. This is so great. And sometimes I will say, I've been praying about that. I'm so glad. Why did I need to say that?
So they realized that they weren't the only one.
No. Why did I say it?
You're taking it yourself.
Yeah. I wanted a little bit of that focus on me. I did not need to say that.
See, I don't think that. I would have thought, God took care of it. She was praying for us, and God took care of it. Look how He answered that prayer.
And that's great that you would think that. But I have to examine my own heart, right?
Yeah.
Why did I say that?
Yeah.
And I have to think about that. I could just as easily said, I'm so glad God answered our prayers. Right?
Yeah. Well, and again, God knows our motives, doesn't He?
Absolutely.
You know, when I do good, there's always sin lurking.
Right, exactly.
And don't you think part of that is too, because publicly we only thank God for things that seem to go right,
exactly.
As opposed to thanking God in the midst of the things that just seem to be in such disarray.
Yep, yep, exactly.
And I think that's where we get the idea of the Santa Claus God.
Yes.
It's because our public prayer is only about, this has been so great.
Right.
God gave me what I wanted.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's where that subtlety kind of goes, is like, it's really about what I want more than God is a good God. So, again, always a little bit of care taken when we're looking at these Psalms of Thanksgiving. Notice also, and you'll know that whoever wrote this psalm was actually focused on God. If you count how many times he uses the word God or his pronouns, as opposed to either himself or us together, he uses God's name 41 times. In the Thanksgiving Psalms, this is what you're going to see, is the one biggest key word is going to be God's name over and over and over again. So then he addresses God, inviting each group to do so as well. Say to God, So, of course, then the training language is example. I've done this. You say to God this. Say to God thank you. Say to God that he's great. He's done great things. The fact that the Thanksgiving Psalms address everybody. They address the people at the table. They address God, and they address the people not even at the table. Shows us the wholeness of what Thanksgiving does. That it brings us into a wholeness that includes all humanity and God. This picture of this perichoretic conversation going on. The poetic language in Psalm 66, one of the things I point out is that there's an inclusio. There's a bless the Lord, bless our God, and then toward the end, the last line is bless be God. And in between those, we have the nation's distress, the nation's constriction, and the psalmist's own distress. And he alludes to the fact that he has participated in both imprecatory psalms and lament psalms. When he says, God has given heed to the voice of my prayer. God's heard my prayer. What prayer is he talking about there? His lament and his imprecatory psalms. Do you understand that? Okay. And the trust psalms as well. We know he definitely was praying trust psalms in that he tells about the lessons he learned from those. And the trust psalms are always this time of waiting when I learn what God's really doing, what God is really about, what God's character is. And so he learned that their time of constriction was for their good, to refine them, to make them whole and desire God's presence. And this is a part where we always tend to want to take things out of context. Toward the end, 1, 2, 3, 4... 5, the fifth line of this last stanza. Robin, would you read that?
If I regard wickedness in my heart, the Lord will not hear.
Okay, so we've talked about this. Robin and I have talked about this a couple times, where we have this idea that God won't hear the wicked. That's not what that verse says there. If God does not hear the wicked,
nobody will.
Exactly. Exactly. God hears the wicked. What he doesn't hear is the wicked cry. The wicked cry is what James says. James 4 says, you ask, but you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives. Mm-hmm. You ask for things for your own pleasure rather than for participating in my life. Those prayers, I'm not going to pay attention to because they're not for your good. That's what that means there. So don't let anybody ever tell you God does not hear prayers of the wicked, because that's it. We're in trouble there, right? And then we just throw the whole Bible out if God doesn't hear the prayers of the wicked. But he does. He will not listen. He will not pay attention for you praying for things that are only for your pleasure and not for participating in his life. This inclusio then shows why we thank God. Because he keeps us in life, it says. And when it talks about that, it means he keeps open life for us to participate in his life. That's the only life there really is his life. This perichoretic life is the only life there really is. He doesn't turn away from us. His hesed compels him to keep those open. He keeps answering, it keeps opening. Come on in, participate in my life. And Israel remembers that Moses said, God, without you, without your presence, we're nothing. We're not a people without you. And that is the idea that the psalmist is trying to get at. That our thanksgiving is thanking him that we're continually available to walk into the gates of his righteousness and walk into his holy presence, his perichoretic life. Okay, Psalm 118. Who has that? Yes.
It makes me think of Philippians, where Paul, it's almost the perichoretic circle of, you know, you're anxious, so go to God in prayer, supplication, thanksgiving, it's all this progression of these kinds of psalms.
Yep.
And then you have the peace, then God gives you the peace.
That's exactly it. That's
and
exactly
also,
how it goes.
You said this in our study or somewhere I heard, where in the epistle, Paul never addresses the people. He didn't say, hey, thank you for participating in God. He always thanks God. Or whatever, you know,
yep.
Always addressing God.
And he always shares it with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I thank God in all my remembrance of you. Yes, that's so cool. All right, girls.
Will you turn to Psalm 118, either in your books or your Bibles? We really noticed a lot of repetition as an emphasis in this psalm, and so we are actually going to kind of do this like a script. So Linda is passing out different parts that people will play in our performance.
Sounds like
singing that script. And so what we will do, there'll be parts that just Linda will read, parts that just I will read, and then if you have a script, when your part is highlighted in yellow, please read that part. There'll be a few parts that we read all together. So right here in the beginning, we're going to say the first two lines together. And then I'm going to say kind of the, like, calls to respond, and then everyone will say together, his loving kindness is everlasting. And we'll do that again together at the end, because it starts and starts and ends the same way. So, you ready? Everyone has their part? Okay.
No.
Oh, there's only a few people that had parts. Yeah, sorry, sorry.
So, I'm sorry, are we all reading this verse?
Just the first two lines together.
Okay, sorry.
And then respond in the first paragraph as well with the lines of say his ever her his
loving kindness.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I'll guide us.
All right.
So all together, give
thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his loving kindness is everlasting.
Now just me. Oh, let Israel say,
his loving kindness is everlasting.
Oh, let the house of Aaron say,
his loving kindness is everlasting.
Oh, let those who fear the Lord say,
his loving kindness is everlasting.
From my distress, I called upon the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me in a large place. The Lord is for me, I will not fear. What can man do to me? The Lord is for me among those who help me. Therefore, I will look with satisfaction on those who hate me.
It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes.
All nations surround me.
In the name of the Lord, I will surely cut them off.
They surround me, yes, they surround me.
In the name of the Lord, I will surely cut them off.
They surround me like bees. They are extinguished as a fire of thorns.
In the name of the Lord, I will surely cut them off.
You pushed me violently so that I was falling, but the Lord helped me. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation.
The sound of joyful shouting and salvation is in the tents of the righteous.
The right hand of the Lord does valiantly. The right hand of the Lord is exalted. The right hand of the Lord does valiantly.
I will not die, but live, and tell of the works of the Lord. The Lord has disciplined me severely, but he has not given me over to death.
Open to me the gates of righteousness. I shall enter through them. I shall give thanks to the Lord. This is the gate of the Lord. The righteous will enter through it. I will give thanks to you, for you have answered me, and you have become my salvation.
The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. This is the day which the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it.
O Lord, do save. We beseech you. O Lord, we beseech you. Do send prosperity.
Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. We have blessed you from the house of the Lord. The Lord is God, and he has given us light. Bind the festival sacrifice with cords to the horns of the altar.
You are my God, and I give thanks to you. You are my God, I extol you.
And everyone together, give
thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his loving kindness is everlasting.
I love, as all of you have been doing this, and everyone has been just really wonderful, that you're beginning to pick out exactly where the lesson goes, and you know, and Alex, when you said, now there's repetition in here, and it makes the focus emphasize on this. I'm thinking, well, that's in my, did she look at the lesson? it's really fun to be able to see that, that you guys can pull that out. So Psalm 118, book
five,
book five. So we're at the very end of the Psalm books. Historically, what's happening then in book five? Yeah, return from exile. So obviously you can see why a Thanksgiving psalm would be a return from exile. In fact, this is a whole section of Thanksgiving psalms. But even more so, I actually had so much fun looking at where this probably came from, because I just wanted to teach it again. So when we think about historically where what's happening is return from exile, we have to think about the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai. And we begin, as if we put ourselves there, literally, I just spent one day just reading through Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai. And it's just like, I love these books. These books to me are so fascinating. And when you go back there and then read this psalm and you recognize that probably Ezra and Nehemiah wrote this, oh, all of this makes so much sense about what was going on there. There are too many words in common with Ezra and Nehemiah in this psalm to have written them down. I've written down almost all of the words. It's just over and over again.
Excuse me, you said Ezra and Nehemiah, and what was the first?
Haggai.
Haggai.
Everyone says it Haggai, yeah.
I didn't know
what you're
saying.
Yeah, the emphasis is on the last syllable. Some of the words are distress, surrounding, loving kindness, gates, blessing, thanks. But it goes on. I mean, there's just so many of them. And the more I remember them as very short books. So I thought, oh, this is only three chapters. No, they're a lot longer. But you're just like, oh, taking them in and realizing what is going on there. So if you don't know the stories of Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai, which all take place at the same time, and they overlap one another, so it's hard to tell which happened first and second and third. Although we know pretty much where Haggai is in the middle of Ezra. The narrative is about rebuilding the temple and the walls of Jerusalem when they come back from Babylon. And for both Ezra, who is helping to rebuild the temple, and Nehemiah, who's helping rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, both of them have enemies surrounding them. And literally, when you read Nehemiah, literally surrounding them. Around the whole wall of Jerusalem, all of these enemies are coming. And the enemies are from all different nations because that's what's living in the land, right? So when they got exiled, all sorts of other people came in. And now Israel's back. They're trying to rebuild it. And all these other nations are surrounding them. They don't want them to build it. They don't want them to build the temple. They don't want them to build the walls. And so they try to get them to stop building, right? In both both times, both for the temple and for the walls. And they're so intimidating with the temple that, although the bigger description of the intimidation is for the walls, interesting enough, but the temple, what happens when they're building the temple and these enemies are trying to get them to stop?
The foundation stood empty for 16 or 17 years.
Exactly. So they actually get them to stop building the temple, right? Mm-hmm. So all the enemies get them to stop building the temple. And what happens during that time, as you'll read in Ezra, is that, so first of all, when you think about building the temple, do you know who was in charge of building the temple? What group of people? Yeah, it was the priests. It was the Levites. So the Levites are called the builders. When they stopped building the temple, they were so afraid of the enemy, rather than fearing God, right? They began to go back to their household and start, this is what Haggai talks about, right? Building their own houses, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And in building their own houses, not only were they concerned only about their own houses, but Ezra tells us, and he gets really angry with them, as does Nehemiah, they marry the foreigners of the land. They're Levites. They're supposed to know what God's word said about marrying foreigners, right? They're not supposed to do that. And yet, when they stop building the temple, they go and they assimilate with the people in the land. And they begin to do exactly opposite of what God has told them. So that when, nobody knows for sure that Ezra or Nehemiah wrote this, but it sure fits here. When it talks about the stones that the builders rejected became the key cornerstone, yeah. The stone of the temple, when it reject, almost for probably 85% of the times the Old Testament uses the word reject, is to reject the law. And the law is connected with the temple. So that the Levites, the builders, reject the law, the temple, the place of God that said to them, to keep holy and pure, I want you to do this. And they reject that, right? They stop building the temple and they become assimilated with the people of the land. And so that is a rejection of God, right? It's a rejection of the temple. It's a rejection of, well, we're going to be more concerned about living, building our own houses and living a way that feels comfortable. And so we have this rejection of the temple, basically. What happens because of that, because they stop, because they're becoming assimilated with the people, and the same thing with Nehemiah, although they don't ever stop, is both Nehemiah and Ezra cry out to God. God, you've got to help us here. We are not strong enough. We don't have the power to do anything about this. You have to do this. And, of course, in miraculous ways, it goes back to Babylon, and the kings actually end up not just allowing the building to happen, but I love this. We're going to pay for it, the kings say. The kings of Babylon say, we're going to pay for it. We're going to pay for the temple to be rebuilt and the wall to be done. So what we have then for Ezra, when they go back and they finish the temple, they end up celebrating then the Feast of Booths. So that's when the temple's finished, the first celebration they have is the Feast of Booths, or Feast of Tabernacles. Which is interesting because Psalm 118 is actually a part of the celebration of the Feast of Booths. So this is one of the reasons we think maybe Ezra might have been at least have a hand in writing this. And when they read Psalm 118, or at least say Psalm 118, it could have been written right then and there, the people weep because they haven't heard this for so long. And they just weep at what God has done for them, even in the midst of their own rejection of them. Nehemiah's efforts, so Ezra's efforts end in the Feast of the Booths being celebrated and reading Psalm 118. Nehemiah's efforts end, and I love the end of Nehemiah. Do you remember what happens at Nehemiah? He gathers everybody. The wall is done. And remember, we built this. We did some building, right? Yeah. We built the walls, and all the walls had to have a lot of gates in them, right? Yeah. Open gates. And so at the end of Nehemiah, they have this huge procession that everyone comes to the gate, to the open gates that are restored. Gates are now restored so that they can come into Jerusalem. And there's all sorts of gates, right? He names the gates over and over. Nehemiah names gates over and over and over again. And we see all these gates.
They still celebrate the Feast of the Tabernacles.
Yeah, they still do. But Nehemiah's not celebrating the Feast of the Tabernacles. He's celebrating the opening of the gates. That Jerusalem is now open to be able to live in and be secure, right? And the procession is beautiful. If you read maybe chapter 7, the procession is so cool. There are so many times where I think, oh, we should reenact this. Because you have priests lining. So if you know about some of the gates in Jerusalem, their walls have little ramparts. Is that what you would call them? Little walkways around them. So you can walk around most of the walls of Jerusalem. So some of the Levites are on top here. Some are lining the place. And everyone is just in this throng of going to the open gates. They're celebrating that Jerusalem is now a place to live and dwell with God, and it's open and safe. So we have this beautiful idea, and it says that as they did this, as they processed into the gates, they offered sacrifices and they sang songs of thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Probably Psalm 118. So probably Ezra and Nehemiah used this psalm, most likely wrote it for those celebrations of both the temple and the wall. So that Thanksgiving begins with the Exodus, with thanking God for his redemption, his cry, but also then we remember the cries of Ezra and Nehemiah. who said, let's rebuild again. And God, we can't do this because our enemies surround us. If you would do it for us. And he enables, in some miraculous ways, go back and read Ezra and Nehemiah, it's pretty cool, to see that God answers them and they're able to rebuild the temple and the walls and give songs of thanksgiving because of God's cries to them. And because they're able to do that, again, we see that God's desire is to rebuild his people, right? To bring them back into a place where they can dwell safely with God. And the deeds of Ezra and Nehemiah result in them entering the gates of, and they would call them the gates of salvation. And just as an aside, you know that the word salvation in Hebrew, you know what that is? Yeshua.
Yeshua.
So that's the historical background of what's going on as this psalm is being written and sung for the first time. It's in opening the gates of Jerusalem, a place where they once again can live in the presence of God. So the Torah parallel, of course, is Deuteronomy. Just like the return from Babylon is their second chance, right? They've been exiled in Egypt and they were delivered. Now they were exiled in Babylon and they were delivered again. So it's always this, again, God delivers them. Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law because he gave them law once and they immediately disobeyed it before it was even out of the hands of Moses. And so Deuteronomy is, here's a second chance. I'm bringing you again into my company. And when we do covenant, we're going to really talk a lot more about Deuteronomy and what's happening with that giving of the second law. Temple language. Again, we have, because it's a psalm of thanksgiving, it's addressed to several people, right? Lots of people. It's not just addressed to the people at the table or just to God. It's addressed to, and here he starts with Israel. Then he goes to the house of Aaron, who are the priests, right? So he goes from Israel to family, right, to vocation, basically, and then to those who fear the Lord, the individuals. So society, community, individual. And then he shows them what it looks like to give thanks to the Lord, and he gives an example of how he does it. We need to understand that we can't have a grateful society if it's made up of ungrateful citizens, right? And so when we think about even our society, even though it's talking here about Israel and then the church, when we think about our own society, if the church are priests and they're supposed to be giving thanksgiving so that our own family community and then radiates out to the society to be a grateful people, and we're not giving thanks, do you think the world on its own is going to be able to do that? We have such responsibility to live lives of giving thanks, publicly giving thanks, putting it out there about what God has done for us so that the nature of our community changes. And the community of the church should be known for being this absolutely, like, those people are always thanking God. And yet, what are we known for?
Grumbling.
Always being against, right? And yet, the Psalms tell us this is what the world should see. The world should be hearing us all the time saying, God has been so good to us. Look what God has done. Look what God has done over and over and over again. That's the type of people that we should be. That's the type of people that the psalmists assume that we're going to be. So
they
that
keep looking at, well, look what happened. Is that good? Is that a good God?
Yeah, but here's the thing. If we were people who are always giving thanks, remember what happens in the brain? We begin to change what the brain sees and looks at, right? Mm-hmm. So when a society is so focused on all of the horrendous things that are happening, mm-hmm. it means that we have a base that is not grateful, that is not giving right. thanks. Mm-hmm. Guys, we're the base. Mm-hmm. So it's on our heads, not on society's heads. It's on our heads because mm-hmm. they don't know. They don't have that connection. We're the ones who actually have to be that.
Why would a good God allow it? That's the problem.
And you know why? Because we haven't told them what the good God has done. Mm-hmm. So it can never be on their heads. It's always on us. Mm-hmm. The poetic language, like the girl said, is repetitive. It has this stair-step thing where it emphasizes the focus. Each stanza has a different focus about God's good, about what God has done and what he is like, his character. So the first one is a focus on his loving kindness. The second one on is his being for me and wanting to give me this large place, opening up this large place for me. The third is that he is a better refuge than any man or princes. And when you think about that, remembering that it was written during Ezra and Nehemiah's time probably, it's interesting because both Ezra and Nehemiah are arguing with the princes of the world, of the land there. There's all these different princes that are against them. They even have a prince housed in their temple. Do you remember that story about the Sanballat housed in there? And the psalmists say, no. God is our refuge. Not trying to politically align ourselves with other people. God is our refuge. He's better than that. The fourth stanza is the ability for God to cut off what surrounds me, what constricts me. The fourth is God's right hand is able to bring life. The fifth, the open gates that we're able to enter. And lastly, the Lord alone is God. When it says the Lord is God, what it really says is Yahweh, he alone is God. Not all of these other gods, not the princes, not anything else. He alone is God. And then he says, and he's my God. So he individualizes that. And that's why we give him thanks. There is, in the center, there are these antithetical parallelisms. So we haven't talked about our parallelisms for a while. Although we have this stair-step parallelism, right? It keeps on saying, the Lord is good, his loving kindness is everlasting. We have this antithetical from constriction to broad place, from distress to big place, from surrounding to being able to cut off. So it's this, the antithetical of... this is really key for seeing what's in Psalm 118. Again, we have an inclusio. What's an inclusio?
Beginning
and end are the same. So it doesn't have to be the beginning and end. It can be anywhere, right? Because we have some inclusios other places. But the beginning and end of this are definitely the same. Give it thanks to the Lord for his good. His loving kindness is everlasting. And it ends with that. So that tells us the whole psalm is about... tells us that it's about God's goodness, the aspects of God's goodness and all that he has done. And that's what every single stanza delineates. God is this. God is a God of loving kindness. God is for me, etc. Again, as we look at these psalms, I feel like I'm just like plowing through them and we could spend a day at least on each psalm. I hope that we're beginning to get a taste of the richness of the psalms here, and that you would dig a little bit more for those. When we look at the New Testament, we will see Psalm 118 in a lot of places. We don't see Psalm 66, except for allusions, but we will see Psalm 118 everywhere. All four Gospels quote it. And not only do they quote one part of it, they use other parts in different places. Luke uses an Acts. Luke uses it in Acts. Luke writes about it, but it's Peter's speech in Acts that quotes this. And then Peter, in his own letter, quotes it in 1 Peter. And then in Hebrews, it's quoted as well. So this is a big deal here. And it's because everybody said it every single Feast of the Passover and at the Feast of Booths, they would know it very well. When we get to the New Testament, we begin to see the messianic prophecy that it begins to be. But remember, you have to always first begin with what it was when it was written. It was written probably Ezra and Nehemiah's time about rebuilding the temple and how it was that they rejected the stone for a while, right? And here's the exciting part, if you understand that they rejected the Levites, the priests, the builders, rejected the stone for a while. But then, because the Lord was marvelous, he brought them back to redo it. So that's also a reminder that the redemption of the world will include Israel coming back again as well. So we have all of those little pieces, knowing what the historical context is, will help us to understand that. So when it's looked at as a messianic prophecy, we see, first of all, that Jesus is the one who comes to open the gates. And this is beautiful because the biggest use of this is when, on what day?
Palm Sunday,
right? Palm Sunday. When the people actually begin to proclaim Hosanna, which means do save us, right out of Psalm 118. They're quoting that. Do save us. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. The word comes, though, is really the word enters. So it's blessed is he who enters in the name of the Lord. Again, the opening of the gates to be able to live in God's presence and participate in his life. That's what the Gospels are all using that in Psalm Sunday, on Palm Sunday. Jesus is going to be the one to open the gates to participate in God's life again. And then when we read that, you should think about the procession of Nehemiah, of him going in and being so grateful that once again God has restored his people to being able to live in his life, in his the city where his name dwells. Also, Psalm 113 through 118 are used, those psalms are always recited during the Passover. So, Judy, does your son-in-law do this whole thing when he does the Passover?
They do different parts of it. Sometimes they do the whole thing, but sometimes they do nothing. I mean,
random. Usually Psalm 113 and 118 is read all during the Passover, but in different parts. So 113 and 114 is called the Little Hillel, and that's read during the first and second cup. Psalm 115 through 18 is the Great Hillel, Hillel to praise God. And that's sung after the fourth cup. We'll get there in just a second. But they say this through in their Passover celebration to remember again God's redemption and to thank God. This is their thanksgiving to God, what he has done to redeem them. So I do love that in remembering the Passover, they don't just remember what happened. They don't just tell the story. They actually do this psalm. Thank you, God, for what you've done. And they literally bring it up. I don't think in any of our celebrations, even in our Easter celebration, we have a specific time of thanking God for how he's redeemed us. We talk about it a lot, but I don't think we have a specific practice where we do this. And I've always wondered, God commanded the Jews to practice Passover, to celebrate Passover eternally, ever, forever. And I always wonder if we shouldn't be doing that as well. Because it is a time where we actually set aside a time to thank God that he has redeemed us. That he has redeemed us beginning in Egypt and then coming all the way to our redemption.
We sort of do that with the bread and the wine, with the Lord's Supper.
Yeah, and that's interesting because what is that called? I wish we called it this more often.
Eucharist.
To give thanks. So if we brought that out in our communion services and we started calling it Eucharist again and remember what that means, yeah, that is it, Pat. You're right. But we've kind of buried that, right? Mm-hmm. Even just by calling it something else instead of
Churches call Eucharistic ministers, so that is still used.
Right. But you're in a liturgical church.
Yeah.
Most of them are not, right? So in your regular evangelical churches, Eucharistic ministers... Nope. So liturgical churches will still call it Eucharist. And I think that's a really rich way of remembering. This is a giving of thanks as we receive what he's given us, right? And then we give him thanks. Then we have Jesus' own use as he becomes the one. So in Matthew and Mark, when they eat the Last Supper, right? We call it the Last Supper when they're eating the Passover Supper. It says... At the end of both Matthew and Mark's time, they says, and they went out singing a hymn. This is the hymn they were singing. Okay, so this is the hymn they were singing, Psalm 115 through 118. It's kind of interesting because this hymn is supposed to be sung during and after the taking of the fourth cup. And interesting enough, they don't actually take the fourth cup in the Last Supper. And I don't want to get into this, but there's some interesting conjectures about when did they take the fourth cup? When does Jesus actually drink the fourth cup? So we look at that, the fact that they're singing it during the time when he's leaving and then going into being able to go to the crucifixion. Mm-hmm. So talk about, remember he talks about, let this cup pass from me. Mm-hmm. We're talking fourth cup all this time. So some pretty interesting, I read several things about where's the fourth cup? And remember Jesus says, I won't drink this until I come into the kingdom again. With you, right? So the fourth cup, each cup that they drink during the Passover signifies a thanksgiving for something particular, a thanksgiving from oppression, a thanksgiving to freedom, etc. The fourth cup is a thanksgiving for making them a people. So once they came out of Egypt, it makes them a people. It actually, it's the opening up the pericritic circle to make us participate in God's life as his people. And of course, at this time, Jesus becomes then the festival sacrifice bound to the altar. That is a picture that goes back to the ram caught in the thicket. So that's that picture is, remember when God provided the sacrifice for Abram when he was sacrificing Isaac. That's what this is referring to. And so that we have all the way from there. As soon as we see that, if I was a Jew and I'm reading this, bind the festival sacrifice with cords to the horns of the altar, I think right back to Abram. Mm-hmm. And when I think right back to Abram, then I'm thinking Abraham and covenant. What has God promised? God has promised to make us a people that will bless all peoples. And then when we have this in Psalm 118, and we have Jesus walking out to this, this is what he's singing as he's going to be arrested and be put on the cross. This is him. So we have this picture of, oh, he's fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant. He's being the festal sacrifice bound to the altar, the horns of the altar. Everyone, every time I mention some of these, I think, oh, we could spend a lot of time on this. We don't really have that time. Then Jesus as the cornerstone. So that piece of the psalm. The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Now, when you know who the builders are, right, as they are the Levites, that they rejected, has become the chief cornerstone. Again, Jesus becomes the cornerstone. We know that Peter has told us this a million times, that it's him that's going to be, the God's people are going to be rebuilt and reestablished, even though Israel rejects them, rejects him for a time. And then he says, this is the day that the Lord has made. Looking back to Genesis, creation story, right? Now a new day of creation. This is what I mean by the Psalms of Thanksgiving. They go everywhere in the Torah. They just look at all the pieces of what is happening in the Torah. And then, of course, on that living stone, Peter talks about the fact that it makes way for a newly restored people, right? Because that's when Peter says, although the living stone was rejected, now we're going to be built on top of that and become a royal priesthood, a holy nation. And he quotes then from the Torah that we become the people rebuilt in order. And this is where sometimes we leave it off. Yes, we are a royal priesthood. Yes, we are a holy nation. But for what reason? That we may proclaim his excellencies of him who called us out of darkness into light. And then it ends with, and you shall not be put to shame. So it ties it all back into going back to Genesis, restoring who we're supposed to be, proclaiming his excellencies, which is a reflection of who he is. All of that is exactly what was happening in Ezra and Nehemiah. He was restoring his people back to be able to proclaim his excellencies. Just a few other important points of giving thanks in the New Testament. Not giving thanks is a problem. So Romans 1 talks about the fact that although they knew God, they did not honor God or give thanks to him. I think it's kind of funny that we concentrate on they did not honor God, but then we forget they didn't give thanks to him. That's part of being outside of saying, I don't want to have part of God. I don't want to participate in that pericritic circle. So that a life that lives apart from God is a life that doesn't thank God, and that eventually God will leave them off to their own isolating devices. Not vocalizing thanks. In 1 Corinthians, Paul tells us, if you give thanks with only your spirit, this is talking about people who speak in tongues, I think, how can anyone in the position of an outsider say amen to your thanksgiving? If you don't vocalize your thanksgiving, there's no invitation. There's no invitation to say, hey, look at how great God is. Look what God does. You have to vocalize it. Thanks also replaces foolish talk. Let there be no filthiness or foolish talk nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead, let there be thanksgiving. Thanks in every situation. This is what Kate mentioned, right? Philippians 4, don't be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
On the news media, they said something about some of these horrid comedians, and I don't even remember their names because I don't care. But the point is, they are now just about, nobody's wanting to go near them. People are not getting their tickets. And I think that it's about time that we're getting back with God and people understanding how God's rule is and how we turn to God.
Well, let's hope that is true, right? Definitely.
I don't know. That's my little kind of hope. When God's in our world.
One of the things we need to understand is that our conversation does not end with our cry to God. It has to begin to listen, wait for, watch, and embrace the answers that he gives us that we might give thanksgiving. Our praying always means we're always in conversation. Whether we're crying, whether we're waiting for an answer, or whether we've gotten the answer, we're always in that movement of being participating in his life if we're ready to give him thanks. So, 3 minutes for application. Practicing thanksgiving is essential to a full participation in God's life. It responds to a received answer of your call, which presupposes that you have practiced calling. Sometimes we don't call. And then our thanksgiving is usually very, like something nice happens, maybe we'll thank God, maybe not. But if I've called, I'm waiting, right? I'm waiting to hear what's he going to answer so that immediately when I see that answer, I'm ready to give him thanks. And that means the imprecations and the laments and the trust types. Our call is answered first and foremost in the redemption of Israel in Exodus. So that if I'm waiting for a cry, for an answer to him, it doesn't mean I can't give him thanks. It means thank you that you redeemed Israel, because in your redemption of Israel, you brought along the history so that Israel would actually be delivered to become a people of God. They would go into the land, and however poorly they did it, they established God's name in a place and produced a seed that actually brought our redemption, right? That would do Israel right and bring our redemption. So, and this is something I've been practicing this week. I'd never thought about the fact that my Thanksgiving begins with Torah. My Thanksgiving begins with God's redemption of Israel. And I recognize that what he's done in Israel allowed me to be redeemed. So that if I'm sitting waiting for him to answer me, I still have cause to thanks. Mm-hmm. And when I began to thank God for that, all of a sudden I began to see all these other ways he's answered, not just in history, but in my own history. So that it isn't merely just, I just want this God, and when you answer this, I'll give you thanks. Mm-hmm. It's, I want this God, and I want to thank you for the answer. Mm-hmm. How have you already started answering? You already start answering beginning with Israel and then broadening it out. So that it becomes a very daily thing to see how God has answered our thanksgiving, even before we cried out, right? That he's begun it in history. That's, I would challenge you to begin thanking God for the redemption of Israel in Egypt and then in Ezra and Nehemiah's time, and then as we go into